See, that was also, if those of you who have your Smiths history, that was a B-side to one of the later Smiths singles. I can't remember right now, but it certainly was a B-side for them as well. And we started things off there with the Vaseline's "Jesus Wants Me for a Sunbeam" from the Way of the Vaseline's, a complete history released on Sub Pop many moons ago. But right now, I want to get to this. Keith James, and we're going to hear the title track, I'm sorry, the opening track, Once in Your Life, right here on WFMU. Okay, and that's going to do it for today. Keep James, Once in Your Life, Brian Eno, on some faraway beach. Thanks, everyone. Had a great time. Thank you, Scott, for having me. This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Hope to talk to you soon. Bye.
Blank! It's the last Saturday in July. I'm walking through Soho with Julie, who's visiting from France. She's decided to spend her 3-week vacation here in the city with me. But I can tell she's already thinking it was a bad idea. My air conditioner's broken, and I have absolutely no interest in exploring the best beaches of New Jersey with her. And then I get a phone call from my friend John. He has a proposition for me. If I drive his car from Chicago to Los Angeles, he'll pay for the gas and the plane tickets. Think of it as a free vacation, he says. John and his wife Andrea are moving to Washington, D.C., and just as they're about to donate their car to a Chicago charity, he tells me Andrea's mother, who lives in Los Angeles, calls them with an idea. Find someone who can drive the car to L.A., and then when you come to visit, you'll never have to get a rental car. So all you need, I say, is to find someone who can just pick up and go, someone who has nothing going on. Exactly, he says, which is why I'm calling you. This is not entirely fair. I have my radio show, and plus, there's Frenchie. Why not bring her along, he says. So I tell him I'll run the idea by Julie and call him right back. When I ask her if she wants to drive across America, her eyes get really big. Are you serious? She says. This is awesome. American road trip? Wow, so cool. Then she takes out her iPhone and calls her sister. I still don't really speak any French, but I can make out something along the lines of, oh my God, I'm gonna be like Jack Kerouac. We're walking down Prince Street, and when I call John back, she runs into the McNally Jackson bookstore. She says, I'm gonna buy a guidebook. I tell John it's a go, that we'll fly to Chicago on Monday and drive the car to Los Angeles. I knew you'd be able to do it, he says. Just think about how many radio shows you'll be able to make out of this. You won't have to do any more crummy repeats. Before I can tell him what a crummy remark that is, he hangs up. Julie comes out of McNally Jackson waving a book at me. It's a copy of Democracy in America by Alex de Tocqueville. Are you kidding me? I say, shaking my head. No, she says. I can read this to you as we drive through the landscapes. It will be super cool. Alexis de Tocqueville is most famous for his writings about the road trip he took across America in 1831. But later in life, when he retreated from politics to his library, he focused his great democratic genius on other countries, England, Ireland, and Algeria. He believed the Algerian conquest was a wonderful opportunity for France to heal its wounded national pride. But he cautioned against a government that was too liberal. He called for racial segregation, citizenship for the settlers and the Jews, and servitude for the Algerian Muslims. He was certain that any other form of government would only result in strife and conflict. On Sunday night, as we're packing, John calls. Uh-oh, he says. The car died this morning. This is bad, I reply. Well, we put a new battery in, and then it was alive again. That is good, I reply. But then, he says, it died again, and we had to leave it in Bob and Ann Hill's garage. We leave at 7 in the morning to fly to D.C. to move into our new home. We don't have time to deal with this. I don't think you should come. I think we should just cancel the trip and donate the car to charity. Across the room, Julie's waving a blue dress at me. Is this more Montana or Utah? She whispers. I can't bring myself to ruin this for her. So I convince John that since he's already on the hook for the plane tickets, it will probably be cheaper in the end for us to just take the car to a mechanic in Chicago and get it fixed. And thus, the next morning, I'm in Bob and Anhil's garage trying to jumpstart this 1997 Nissan Maxima. Andrea Salenzi picked us up at the airport, and now she, Julie, and I are trying to figure out how to use the jumper cables. Finally, Julie suggests we turn Andrea's car on. And voila, the car starts. According to Wikipedia, we need to drive the car around the neighborhood for a bit so the battery can recharge. Every time I hit a speed bump, the trunk flies open. I call John. I got the car started, I tell him, but there's something wrong with the trunk. I hear people yelling in the background. Our carpets are soaking wet, he screams. We can't even move our stuff. But what about the trunk? I ask again. Oh, that, he says. Well, the latch broke about 3 weeks ago. But don't worry about that. You need to worry about the alternator. Really? How do you know it's the alternator? Well, he says, this guy sitting next to me on the plane told me. And it shouldn't cost that much. So, good luck. And with that, he hangs up. Now, I don't know anything about cars. And I certainly don't know anything about alternators. In fact, I find the whole thing totally overwhelming. And then I have a vision. I pull the car over and open the trunk. Sure enough, there's a light. And ever since the latch broke, this light has remained on. I flip the latch to the closed position, and the light goes off. Then I turn the car off. Then I count to 10, and then I turn it on again, and the car starts right up. I call John back, and even though he's still dealing with wet carpets, I make him listen to me explain how I am the greatest intuitive genius in the history of auto mechanics. But he isn't impressed. But this doesn't stop me from telling everyone we see in Chicago about my super automotive powers. And at dinner, I make everyone raise their glass in my honor. In fact, the next morning when we drive away, I'm still overflowing with automechanical bravado. But then, 24 hours later, in a parking lot in Murdo, South Dakota, the car is once again dead. Alexis de Tocqueville came to America in 1831, officially to study reformatories and state prisons. And it is in this context that the observations he made on American society, Jacksonian government policies, and income distribution should be made. But alas, the great man continues to be mistranslated and misquoted even in the digital era. For example, Alexis de Tocqueville never said that Americans are enamored with equality. But still, you can find this phrase attributed to him on many political websites and blogs. To tell you the truth, I'm surprised that Wikipedia gets it correct. But it's true. Alexis de Tocqueville was a great champion of inequality. In fact, he believed it was one of America's best incentives for the poor to better themselves. The car dies in front of a diner called the Murdo Special, which kind of sounds like the murder special. And since our car is dead outside in the parking lot, well, it's difficult not to blame the Murdo Special. In fact, my initial thought is that the Murdo Special did it on purpose. Let me explain. The night before, we slept in our tent on a patch of South Dakota nothingness just outside of Murdo. It was actually quite comfortable. For some reason, there was a giant lime green shag carpet in the trunk, which we used as a blanket. And we spent the night huddled close together, reading Alex de Tocqueville by the light of our iPhones. In the morning, when we drive by the Murdo Special, we decide to stop and get something to eat. Julie grabs a table and I go to the bathroom to clean up. But as I'm washing my face, I hear the waitress yelling, "We only have coffee, lady. Do you understand? Coffee. Is that okay with you?" When I return to the table, Julie is shaking. "What just happened?" I ask. "I only tried to order espresso, but I don't think she understood me. Why did she get so mad?" I put my arm around Julie and explain to her that we have crossed the border into a new country, a country called America. I explained to her that the average American has a short fuse and no patience for anything that might sound fancy or good. And I explained to her that Americans pride themselves on their legendary intolerance and bigotry for all things foreign, even pretty girls with French accents. But her eyes are still welling with tears. I don't think I've gotten through to her. But then, the mean waitress shows up with two plates of food. Two plates of food covered with thick slices of melted orange cheese. "Here you go," she says. "Two American omelets." And we both explode with laughter. And I can see now that Julie finally understands what I'm talking about. The facial hair on our waitress bristles as she walks away in a huff, but neither one of us can stop laughing. An old man sitting at the counter swivels around in his chair. His t-shirt reads, "Jesus loves you, dude." Julie takes a few pictures of the food, and I take one of the old dude at the counter, and then I pay our bill, and we walk back to the car, laughing all the way. Which is obviously why the car is now dead. Spiteful revenge for our mockery of Murdo and the American omelet. But our luck hasn't run out yet, because next to the diner, there is a garage. I walk inside. There's a large man fondling a bald tire who says, sure, he can take a look at the car. As he connects the jumper cables to his giant truck, I yammer on and on about the broken trunk and the battery and the guy in the airplane who says it's the alternator, but I can tell he isn't listening to me. He starts up his truck, but nothing happens. I start pumping the gas pedal furiously. What are you doing? He shouts. Don't pump it like that. Wait for it to turn over. This car has fuel injection. I have no idea what that means, but I do know that it's best probably not to admit it. So I take my foot off the pedal and remain silent. I think it's your starter, he says, after a few more tries. I think your starter has hit the pole. I don't know what to say. Now, I have tears welling up. But then, he pulls a hammer out of his back pocket and flips it in the air. Turn the car over, he says, and hold the key. When he hears the click, he leans into the engine and whacks something. And then, with a roar, the car comes back to life. But this time, there's no bravado, only shame and confusion. I mean, what do I do now? Do I pay him? What do you pay someone for hitting your starter with a hammer? Is $5 enough, or will that insult him? What if he gets mad and hits me with the hammer? So I decide the best thing to do is just smile and wave and drive away. And Julie is shocked. She wants me to have the guy show us how to hit the starter with a hammer so we can do it the next time it happens. But I just brush her off. I'm sure I can figure it out, I say over and over again. But I'm lying, and she knows it. An hour later, we drive into the Badlands, but it's difficult to enjoy the scenery because I'm too scared to turn the car off. So while Julie explores the magnificent vistas and climbs the giant rocks, I babysit the car. Idling, I draw a lot of attention, a range of pity, confusion, and fear. It's worse in the Black Hills. This was the part of the trip I had been most looking forward to. But now, camping in the wilderness is out of the question. We can't even stop for lunch in Deadwood. All we can do is drive by the facade from the HBO show a few times. And that is kind of lame. I'm miserable, and I have no idea of what to do. But eventually, the empty light starts flashing on the dashboard, and our hand is forced. It's time to test our luck once again. I pull into a gas station just outside of Sturgis. I turn the car off and fill up the tank. And then I turn the key. Nothing. The car is totally dead. Now, the annual Sturgis biker rally is just days away, and thus the parking lot is filled with giant hogs and burly men with bad tattoos. But bikers tend to know about mechanical stuff, at least they do in the movies, so I walk up to a group of them standing around the porta potties to see if someone knows the hammer trick. I don't notice how gay that sounds until I say it out loud, but before I get the chance to explain myself, I realize that I've just interrupted a prayer circle. This group of bikers is praying. I kid you not, these grizzled, tattooed, scary-looking badasses are all holding hands and praying. One of them asked Jesus to bless the coming bike rally. Another one asked Jesus to keep the skunk weed away from the women this year. And then another guy looks right at me and asks Jesus to keep the homos from ruining marriage. And then the biggest one of them all asked Jesus to do something about the mosque at Ground Zero. This is the first time I hear about that thing, by the way. But even though I don't know what he's talking about, I hear enough to convince me to ask someone else for help. Out front, there's a guy with this amazing bike, the kind with the super long handles, and the flames on his arms match the flames on the tank. He says he thinks he can get my car started, no problem. So I run inside and get him a hammer. It takes him a bit longer than the other guy, but sure enough, he gets the car running. But, he says, I think your starter has s*** the pole. This time, I make sure to show my gratitude. I offer him a baby wipe from the package in the glove compartment so he can wash his hands. But he declines. Dirty is my normal, he says with a smile. According to Google Maps, we're 433 miles away from Bozeman, Montana, our next destination. If we can make it there, we can stay with my friend Guy and get the car fixed for real. So I call John and tell him about the starter. According to Urban Dictionary, s*** the pole means totally broken. But it's not the end of the world, because according to Wikipedia, a starter should only cost a few $100. Wikipedia also tells us that you don't really have to turn the car off when you fill the gas tank. So Julie and I should be able to make it to Montana without turning the car off. But John suggests that just in case, while I'm refueling, Julie should stand as far away from the car as possible. And, he says, make sure she gets that green rug. We really love that thing. It would break our hearts if that rug went up in flames. Alexis de Tocqueville covered a great distance in a mere 9 months. Thus, some find Democracy in America a much more enjoyable read when the insights are taken as roadside impressions rather than evidence of a national character or American identity. In fact, some scholars are baffled that this book remains a cornerstone of political sociology. There have even been calls for its reclassification as American travel literature. But that will never happen. Because the idea that some dude can uncover the secret of America's identity on a summer road trip is one of our most sacred and holy beliefs. You know, it would be irresponsible of me to claim it's 100% safe to keep a car running while you fill it up with gas, because there is a slight risk of explosion and fiery death. So perhaps it's better to say I just got lucky those two times. Of course, it should have been just once, but I panicked the first time and only put in $7 worth of gas, which wasn't enough to get us to Bozeman, so I had to do it twice. It took 3 days to find a mechanic who could fix the car, which was fine by me, because it's been 5 years since my last visit, and it's always great to meet up with old friends and revisit old haunts. But Julie quickly tired of all the cowboy bars, and even though I assured her that Bozeman is more America than America, she spent most of her time reading Alexis de Tocqueville at the food co-op. But once we're back on the road, she brightens up. We camp in Yellowstone, hike in the Targhee National Forest, tool around the polygamous town of Colorado City, and before making a mad nonstop dash to Los Angeles, we visit Zion National Park and the Grand Canyon. Our trip to Zion, sadly, is a bust. This campground charges us $40 for a patch of dirt next to the dumpsters, and as I'm setting up our tent, it starts to rain. Julie tries to help, but I assure her that I have it under control. But in less than 10 minutes, the tent is reduced to a muddy wad of poles and vinyl, which I shove into the trunk, and we sleep in the car. But this, at least, gets us up early and gives us a head start on the hordes. That's really the only thing I remember about our hike up to the Angel's Peak, the number of people. It's better on the way up because, as I said, we got an early start, but just barely. On the way down, it's like worse than Port Authority at rush hour. People everywhere, all decked out in the latest hiking technology. Aluminum walking sticks, wearable water bottles, and voice-activated pedometers. This experience makes me want to skip the Grand Canyon entirely. But Scott Carrier, who we had lunch with in Salt Lake City, said it isn't a real road trip if you skip the Grand Canyon. So we drive out to the North Rim. And it's much better. It's actually breathtaking. There's this old lodge right there on the rim with a bar and everything. You can even walk around with a beer in your hand. For the first time on the trip, I feel relaxed. I take out a cigar and put my feet up. There's a woman talking on her cell phone sitting next to me. "Do you mind?" she says with a snarl. I pretend I don't understand English, and almost immediately she forgets about me and continues on with her conversation about the unemployment map she just saw on the Glenn Beck show and how it said that the only states with jobs are Texas and Missouri. "They must have God-fearing governors," she says. Unfortunately, I am unable to ignore her. And even though I know I can just get up and move away, I can't. So instead, I just grit my teeth and blow as much smoke in her face as I can muster.
Ever since my dad left my mom for our neighbor, we haven't had the best relationship. The last time we hung out, he spent the night beating a small snake to death with a pool rake. And that's the image that comes to mind when I think of him now. This summer, he invited me on a family vacation to Hilton Head Island in South Carolina. I hope things would be different. So, Dad, what are we doing?
Buying shrimp at Barnacle Bill's.
It's a real tourist experience.
Yep.
Our first day on the island, I set us up on a little father-daughter outing to a seafood store. I found it on Yelp. I was hoping the reviews would be true, and he'd be really proud of me for finding such a great spot.
It's like a shack.
The truth is that the only reason I go on these family vacations is that I need his approval. Every time, I hope that for just a moment he'll look over and say he's proud of me. But he always gets distracted.
Look at the mermaid.
She's topless. Normally mermaids have like seashells or something going on there.
When we get to the front of the line, the guy behind the counter is really friendly.
Barnacle Bill's is the only seafood market here on Hilton Head Island. We've been here for 30 years. We get 2 deliveries a day of the freshest seafood possible. We feed many people on this island, including this fine gentleman by the name of...
Warren.
Warren, yes, which is, I assume...
My dad.
Her dad.
Imagine that.
Imagine that is right.
Yeah.
What did the guy think? That I'm his young wife? Because my dad's young wife, my former neighbor, my old hairdresser... She's back at the condo right now, jealous that we're spending time alone together. The guy playing the Doors covers turns out to be Barnacle Bill. He puts down the guitar and comes over to talk.
So how's the business going this year? How's tourism on the island?
Tourism is up a little bit. Unfortunately, because of the disaster in the Gulf, I would rather not have it that way. But people are coming here for the first time, and they're amazed to see how beautiful this island is. And the beauty itself is unique and rare.
While Barnacle Bill was talking, I started to think. His business is doing great because of disaster. And that's kind of like my life. When my family went all Jerry Springer, I got as far away from the toxic filth as I could. And far away from it all, I do great. But every holiday, I start to think that maybe the oil well's been capped. Maybe we can eat the shrimp this year without getting poisoned.
Visit Hilton Head, visit Barnacle Bill's, among many other stuff that's really worth your time and your energy to come down. Thanks very much.
As we drove home, my dad turned to me. I think he was about to tell me how much he loves me, how proud he is of me, when...
Hey.
Where are you?
I'm turning in right now.
I was just reading the directions on your little box of boil bag stuff.
That's my stepmom, Wendy. She used to live across the street from us. Used to always gross me out how she'd kiss all of her pets on the lips, even kiss her bird on the lips. I'll never forget the night she and her husband came over for dinner, and all of a sudden, she was sitting on my dad's lap, kissing him on the lips, and my mom and Wendy's husband just left to watch a movie upstairs. That's when I learned that suburban couple swapping is for real. Oh well, I guess my dad will tell me all that nice stuff later.
Sally sells seashells by the seashore. Go.
Back at the resort, there were lots of fun events, like a cell phone texting competition.
Harbor Town Lighthouse.
Done.
My brother's girlfriend beat me.
Good job, Kate. How does it feel?
I feel like a champion.
When we got back to the condo, my dad gave my brother's girlfriend a hug, handed her a wine cooler. She was the center of his attention for the night. I thought it was because she won the texting contest, but maybe it was because she's hot. Everyone celebrated my stepmom, Wendy, because she boiled the prawns so well and even removed their shells with her fake nails. I was getting bummed out. The only attention I got was for insisting they leave bacon bits out of the salad. When everyone went to bed, I got to Googling. There has to be something fun for us to do around here.
Yeah, get the hand out. Let's clap them. Every time I say on vacation, you say on vacation. That's your job. Let's try it. On vacation.
I found a really fun show hosted by a world-famous kazoo player.
Well, now let's run to the car. Let's drive down to the beach. We'll cut off the computer. We'll put the cell phone out of reach because we're on vacation.
On vacation.
I said we're on vacation.
On vacation.
We'll get some rest and relaxation.
There were families everywhere. Kids were chewing on pizza rolls, smiling at me with juice box colored lips, and giving me looks like they were sorry for me, because I was there by myself. When I got home from the show, I proudly showed off my new kazoo. But they made fun of me for it, like the next day on the pier.
So what are we looking at right now?
A dolphin.
When did you guys first see him?
About a minute ago.
If you can't tell.
So we're waiting for him to come back. There he is.
Wendy hated that I was recording her.
You gonna play the kazoo for him?
She thought I was doing it to make fun of her.
A dolphin. A minute ago. A dolphin. A minute ago.
But I am not angry with her anymore. About that whole suburban couple swapping thing she and her ex-husband started doing with my parents. I am not bitter that her ex-husband tried to kill my dad with a knife, or that she let all of her cats loose in the neighborhood when she and my dad ran off to Florida. I just think she sounds like a bad Sarah Palin impression.
A dolphin. A minute ago. A dolphin. A minute ago.
I don't know why I care so much about getting attention and approval from my dad. I mean, he doesn't read books. He hates gay people. He has bad taste in women. He's a jerk. But he's my dad. My dad jerk. On our last day, we all found ourselves at a souvenir shop, and my dad and I walked over to check out a talking robotic pirate that tells fortunes.
Oi there! Yes, you! Surrender a small treasure and gain great wisdom.
Should I do it?
I think it'd be fun. So is this your fortune, Dad, or mine?
It's yours. You need a fortune.
I think it could be your dad's fortune.
The pirate here. Listen to this, your future, for I tell you it be true.
Says, you are a very virtuous person. You are not easily influenced. Your relatives have a great deal of respect for you.
Okay, that's a good one.
At this point, my dad could have said, the pirate's right, honey. I have so much respect for you. But he said,
it's got balls in it.
It's a little pirate chest with balls.
Yeah, but look at this. They're magnetic balls.
Maybe next time.
Thanks for the fortune, Dad.
Yeah. Isn't that neat, the magnetic balls?
I was born in Damariscotta, a small town in coastal Maine. Back in 99, when I was 17, I left Maine for the big city, where there were jobs and more people who wouldn't make fun of my dreadlocks. But in the summertime, there is no better place to be but Maine, or vacation land, as the state license plate proclaims. Life is good here in the summer. Bonfire parties, farmers markets, tubing down lazy rivers, picking mussels right off the rocks, and making music. This is my family. This summer, my wife and I borrowed my father-in-law's new Lexus Hybrid for the 7-hour drive up from New York City. When we arrived, we went downtown to watch the July 4th fireworks display. But when we got back to the car, someone had scratched the hood with a key. It looked really bad. And this is my father-in-law's car.
No!
The most likely explanation for this vandalism was the New York plates. And I realized right then and there that this would not have happened to me if I was still a Mainer. But the fresh gouges on the hood of the car made it painfully clear. I was now a summer person. Over the next few days, I gathered some opinions about summer people. I visited bonfires, farmers markets, and I even stopped at a wiffle ball party.
Roof ball!
Do you have anything to say about summer people?
Well, the thing about summer people, you know, summer people, some aren't. You got your mass holes and your kinetic ass and, you know...
Summer people, some aren't.
We love summer people. They're our best customers.
I didn't really know anything about the, you know, about the tension. And, like, I'm driving the wrong way, and this, like, truck comes up the other way and starts, like, laying on the horn. He's like, go the f*** home. And I was like, oh, my God. Brady was like, you got to get these plates off this car.
When I was a kid on the street, I remember people stopping and asking me, how do you get to L.L. Bean? And I would tell them the wrong way to go.
Mainers have always had a love-hate relationship with the summer people. No one wants them to go away, but they also don't want to go out of their way.
Even myself, I will, like, not honk at a Maine plate, but if there's, like, a Mass or Connecticut plate in front of me and they, like, cut me off, I'll, like, lay on the horn, you know? You just see that plate and you feel like the green light is there to unleash a little bit, you know?
I don't know. I don't know if I do that when I vacate, you know, but I think that it does make that. That's what makes it hard, is that, you know, that they're having their thing and you're only part of that as a servant, and you're only part of that as an accessory to their happiness and joy and relaxation. So you do feel a little bit dirty at the end of the day, but then you get your $100 or whatever and you're like, okay, I guess I'll save this for my wood next winter. And really fun stuff like that.
If you don't like summer people, like, go up to Livermore Falls, drive down the main street and see what that's all about. Mm-hmm. Make you think twice about the traffic on the bridge in Wiscasset.
What happens in Livermore Falls?
There's, like, nothing there. There's, like, one little restaurant, the Chuck Wagon, which is worth checking out just for nostalgia. But there's just no... There's no money to keep local businesses afloat, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I thought of it myself, but, you know, in restaurant and hospitality, there's a lot of people who are a little bossy, a little pushy, sometimes maybe a little uppity, maybe think that they deserve something because they're the paying tourist and you're the local server.
You know, I wanted to be a prankster.
Right.
I'm not proud of it.
Look, I have to give my people the benefit of the doubt. These are my friends, my former neighbors and classmates, and I know we are generally pretty nice people. Maybe there could be some other reason that the car got keyed. One that wouldn't force me to pick a side.
Okay, here's what I would like to think. Okay, here's what my first reaction. The truth is, my first reaction, I didn't want to believe it. I wanted to believe someone was wearing Carhartts, and they had those metal studs in the back, and someone was sitting on the hood, hopefully making out or doing something even better. And that's what caused the scrapes. That's what I wanted. Right? Isn't that what you would want?
They're just holding their key very awkwardly and didn't notice.
Or the keys were on the back, and they were, like, humping into their keys or something.
And they didn't notice till they got to the end of the car.
Yeah. And it said, go home, Yankee.
Let it rain, let it pour, let it rain a whole lot more. I got them deep river blues. Let the rain.
About a month ago, I was at a bar with my friend Matt. We'd set up the meeting the old-fashioned way, via voice-to-voice communication, on the telephone, a few days before we met. As Matt was telling me about his full year of unemployment, about not being able to find a new apartment, and generally about some really personal stuff that I wouldn't have known if we hadn't been talking in person, I wasn't paying any attention. Instead, I was scrolling through my Twitter feed, trawling for something more interesting to do later in the night. He went on for a long time, like 20 minutes or so. He said, "I'm suffering here. but I was too busy retweeting something Kanye West wrote because I was thinking maybe my friend Bill would see it because he had just retweeted the same tweet and then he would know I was also in the same neighborhood and maybe he would wait for me because I wanted to go to Tile Bar later. But before I could get this retweet out, Matt knocked the phone out of my hand and said, "Yep, you weren't paying attention to me, were you?" No, I wasn't. See, this is something I do a lot. Twitter, Facebook, and GChat are somehow totally all-consuming for me. Like, including multitasking, I probably spend 60 hours a week using all or one of those applications. There's hope and expectation for me in status messages and shared links and newly location-stamped tweeting and Facebooking. There's always the opportunity to do something better, to do something more interesting. Plus, all the social networking sites are constantly being updated and therefore in constant need of checking. This checking is a part of my life for every moment I'm awake. Why should I enjoy the time I'm spending in the present when there might be something vaguely better to do in the future? Twitter, Facebook, and GChat throw me into the striving spiral of constant social hustling, and even if it's unfair to the people that I'm with in person, social networking is something that I strive to do well. But at that night at the bar, I wondered, if I turned off my constantly churning Bigger Better Dealing application that's always running in the back of my mind, maybe I would be less of a jerk in real life. Most people go on vacations to islands and the woods and mountains and other cities during the summer. The only boat I've been on this summer is a houseboat docked in a canal in Bushwick. But it was with the thud of my iPhone on the bar top that I realized I needed to take a solo vacation this summer. A vacation from the internet. And so, on the morning of July 30th, I decided to give up Twitter, Facebook, and GChat for 6 weeks to take an anti-social network vacation. First, I removed all social networking applications from my cell phone. Goodbye Echo Phone, goodbye Facebook, goodbye Foursquare. This was important to me because my phone is literally always in my face, as Matt pointed out, at most 3 feet away from my face. I turn to it at all times, to look busy, to look something up, to see how my hair looks. And so, without the applications, when I got to a place, I no longer had the ability to broadcast my location in hopes that another friend would join. And maybe, more importantly, for my antisocial network vacation, I couldn't scroll through my apps, idly wondering what the world was up to. The idea was, without the apps on my phone, I'd be constantly living in the present. I'd stand in line at the grocery store and stare at people, rather than my phone. I'd idly stand outside buildings in parks, and at work I wouldn't constantly refresh Twitter. I would thumbs up nothing on Facebook, and my glowing green GChat dot would disappear. I'd be off the grid for 6 weeks. Immediately, my friends and internet acquaintances noticed I wasn't there. "Are you okay? Are you out of the country? Did you get surgery or something? Where are you?" I took a lot of pleasure in the first 2 weeks off the networks, meaning I talked about it constantly. It was like I'd become some kind of martyr for the digital native generations. I spoke with people on the telephone, I sent full-length emails, I abbreviated less, but I also had fewer things to do for sure. Since, and this is the spooky part, 40% of my social times at least were organized via vague, passive messages I sent out into the networks. I stopped getting invited to things, I didn't know when my friends were on real vacations, so I had no one to hang out with on weekends. I found myself wandering aimlessly on Friday and Saturday nights. And so, in the third week, I started giving in to this constant creeping feeling that I was being left out. I started cheating, lurking on Twitter, going invisible in GChat, trolling Facebook. I didn't even enjoy being in the moment. For example, I'd look over the shoulder of strangers in the grocery store when they were looking at their own Twitter updates, seeing if I could recognize someone I followed too. By the end of the third week, I was literally, and this is a buzzword that I hate but is so appropriate, left out of the conversation. Adrift, alone, I felt like I was living in the Stone Age. I started college in 2005. I joined Facebook before I was even at school, and my Facebook friend list and GChat contacts and, more recently, Twitter friends developed along with my in-real-life social network. One is so connected to the other that I can't separate the two. So, by taking myself off of the networks, I was actually forsaking everything I know, and, really, everything I know socially. And that's spooky as hell. But since my group of friends are plugged into the social networks, without engaging, I might as well have not existed. And so, at the end of week three, I gave up on my vacation, with a triumphant return to Twitter, then Facebook, then GChat, all in one delicious afternoon. I learned on my vacation that I am as much of a thumbnail avatar as I am a person. Now all the apps are back on my phone, and I'm back to my old tricks of being vacant and vague and looking at screens more than I'm looking at people. I've tweeted 10 times today.
Hey, there you are, Chris. Chris.
Buddy.
Hey, I got your message.
Thanks so much for meeting me down here.
Yeah, but what are you doing in town? And why in the world would you want to meet here at the World Trade Center? Don't you know there's, like, chaos here? We've got, like, you know, racist bigots around the corner protesting this mosque thing.
Yeah, well, buddy, you better get used to that, because that's not going away till the 5th of November.
Really? You think this is just about the election?
Oh, absolutely. This is not about the mosque, dude. This is about trying to get to 39. The Republicans are trying to win back the House. To do that, they need to take 39 seats. Despite all the stuff you've heard about the general theme of the country switching over to Republicans, we ran the numbers, they ran the numbers, they know that they just don't have it. So, Newt Gingrich, Sarah Palin, found out about this mosque going in. And, you know, the mosque people, I mean, they applied for these permits years ago. They were just trying to calmly go in, you know, next to a goddamn liquor store, for Christ's sake. I mean, you know, they weren't trying to cause any fuss. This is just a place that they had applied for a permit years ago, but they had to make some small modifications to their paperwork. Someone at the RNC heard about it and was like, yes, we have our wedge issue. There's a mosque going in two blocks from ground zero.
So you're saying that that whole rally around the corner is just the result of bad propaganda?
Absolutely. They pushed the hate button and all these assholes are out here screaming for blood. I mean, there are wedge issues. I mean, that's what the Republicans do. Gay marriage, burning the flag, you know, all this kind of crap. But this one is much worse because it is just pure hatred, and we're worried that this is going to tear the country apart. This is all over America. It's not just those people around the corner. I mean, all across the United States, people are losing their shit, and their worst qualities are coming out.
Well, at least you can take comfort in the fact that other Americans are responding. I mean, there are counter-protesters not just here, but all across America who are coming out and saying that, you know, supporting the mosque and supporting tolerance and supporting American freedom.
Actually, that's why I'm here.
What do you mean?
Well, President saw what was going on, could see that the country was tearing itself apart, and he was like, we can't have the message be so one-sided to go out to everybody that this is okay. So he asked everybody to, like, in the administration, take your vacation time. You got to go to New York. We got to organize a counter-protest so that at least it appears like part of America is not okay with this shit.
You're saying that this entire counter-protest is Potemkin?
Yes. It had to be done, man.
But what if, you know, like George Bush did this, like, you know, when, for the war? What if he had had everyone in his administration go down to the mall?
You think?
Oh, my God. So that's why you asked me to meet you down here. You want me to join you on the protest.
Yes. We have to show the world that we're not just a bunch of racist, xenophobic assholes.
But we are. This episode of Too Much Information is called What I Did on My Summer Vacation. It was written and produced by myself and Bill Bowen and featured TMI contributors Andrea Salenzi, Noah Apple, Laura Mayer, and Chris. Visit the TMI playlist page for archived broadcasts and subscribe to the TMI podcast at WFMU.org.